This is Rebecca from New Haven, Connecticut. You are listening to WNHH Community Radio 103.5 FM.
Welcome to Book Talk, where we talk about books. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and today we'll be talking about the brand new novel, The Locals, first with the author, Jonathan Dee, and then with my guests, Sam Purdy and Mark Oppenheimer. And stay tuned at the end of the show for a middle grade recommendation from one of our friendly New Haven librarians. In the small town of Howland, Massachusetts, in the foothills of the Berkshires, there's one post office, one tiny library, one decrepit diner. There are the summer people, wealthy New Yorkers there for the scenery. And then there are the locals, people like Mark Firth, a contractor, his brother Jerry, a real estate agent, his sister Candace, an elementary school assistant principal. The line between the two is clear, until it's crossed, when hedge fund manager Mark Hoddy moves his family to their summer residence full-time in the wake of 9/11 and volunteers himself as mayor. He cuts tax rates to historic lows, foregoing his own salary and offering to shoulder any emergency costs. Is he the town's salvation, or does his rise herald the death of democracy? A disquisition on inequality, class, power, and politics, this novel breaks open the American dream, seeking to see what, if anything, is at its core. I had the opportunity to speak with author Jonathan Dee last week, and I'd like to share that interview with you now. Jonathan Dee graduated from Yale University and currently teaches in the MFA program at Syracuse. His 2010 novel, The Privileges, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. The Locals is his seventh novel. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me today on Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Jonathan, it often makes sense for me to start at the beginning. And the beginning of this book is particularly interesting to me because it's written from the first-person perspective of a character that we never meet again. And to give some context to our listeners, this first chapter takes place in the days immediately following 9/11. And the narrator, whose name we never learn, is a twitchy little man with a criminal record who lives in Manhattan. And he does have a connection with another character, Mark Firth, who goes on to appear throughout the rest of the novel. But I'm really curious about this choice on your part to start with a voice that is so different from the voice from the rest of the novel and to start in a place that's so different from where the rest of the novel takes place. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. You know, well, there are a couple of different ideas that generated that opening. One is that I did want to begin, you know, if not on, then around 9/11, because even though it's tricky, I think, to write fiction about that, I felt like it was in some ways the beginning of a long period of reaction in American life, although it wasn't apparent that that's what it was for quite a while. So I wanted to get it into the book somehow, and I also liked the idea of a prologue that didn't really seem like a prologue, that had a particular off-center quality that showed you, you know, the main character of the book, Mark Firth, but from a really distant and particular and kind of a critical perspective. And then also I have to say that the earliest drafts of that first chapter, the file name on my computer for them was Ape Scene. And that's because I don't know if you have ever seen the Stanley Kubrick movie 2001.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the things I've always loved about that movie is that it has, if you remember that, you know, like 10-minute or so prologue section that takes place in prehistoric times with cavemen discovering tools. And then there's the famous 10,000-year smash cut to from the bone in the air to the spaceship in orbit. So I just liked that idea of a kind of smash cut first chapter that led to the rest of the book, but only in a thematic way.
So in terms of the writing, when you were writing the novel, did you start with that chapter? Did you start with kind of the prologue, or did it come at the end or somewhere in the middle?
No, I started with it. That's pretty much always the way it works for me, for whatever reason, is that every book seems to have a beginning section, and that can be, you know, one scene or it can be 50 pages, whatever, but there's some opening bit that I need to work on for a long time and feel like I've gotten it right. And then only at that point can I go on and start to do a draft of the remainder. But yeah, that was the opening. That was my idea for the opening from the beginning, and I never really moved off of it.
And that narrator is kind of a hard person to like. And I wonder if you think about that. I mean, when you're starting with a voice that could be alienating to the reader. Is that something that, as a writer, concerns you, or do you like kind of presenting that challenge to your audience?
Well, it concerns me, but that doesn't mean that I think about it while I'm writing. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that you know, if it hadn't occurred to me, it certainly would have occurred to me after various editors brought it up, because it was pointed out to me that this was an off-putting voice with which to begin the book, and that readers might not know that this voice was going to, in effect, you know, fall off of the book like the first stage of a rocket after the opening chapter. But I do think about that. I do take that into consideration. But when I'm working, I never think at all about anybody reading it, to be honest. I mean, when I'm working, I'm not aware of any other. As soon as I'm done and I show it to somebody, then I start to become anxious about what they'll think. But, you know, when I was writing it, it was just between me and it. And that's really always the way it is. It's not that I banish thoughts like that for some noble reason when I'm working. It's just the way it works. I don't. It's very solitary.
And so when that gets presented to you by some editors and it's raised, did you think about changing it, or did you feel like, no, this is really, I know this is where it needs to begin?
I thought about changing it. I never thought about changing it completely. There were various smaller suggestions that came up about toning down certain aspects of it, or trying to signal to the reader somehow that the voice in whose presence they were was kind of temporary. So I thought about, I entertained the idea of small adjustments like that to make it a little more reader friendly, but I never entertained the idea of beginning somewhere else. Really.
So I wanted to go back to something you said when you were talking about this chapter, and you said that Mark Firth, the main character in the book, does appear, and that's the way we're introduced to him originally. And I was struck by your calling him the main character of the book, because that actually wasn't the way that I thought about him. I think that I was expecting him to be the main character when that prologue section ends and the first section of the rest of the book begins, and it begins with him on the train going back home to Howland. But then, you know, the book moves away from him a lot, and it's kind of almost like a kaleidoscope approach. It shifts between characters, and some of the characters get more space and time devoted to them, and some get less. But I didn't really feel like he was always at the center of that. And so I'm interested that you, did you feel otherwise?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that the term main character is kind of a blunt one there, but it's a novel with a lot of characters in it. And I suppose if you had to name one of them as not, you know, the dominant, but in some ways the central character, the character to whom the other characters are connected in some way, it would probably be Mark. But I thought of it as, from the beginning is not a novel that would center around one particular figure.
And I found that so interesting because, you know, it didn't really feel like there was a structured approach to who's appearing on stage at any given time. And mm-hmm. I wondered how one goes about writing something like that. I recently did a book for the show called Spoonbenders by an author named Daryl Gregory. And it focuses really on five characters, and it moves through the perspective of each of them, but in this very structured way where it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 consistently throughout the book. And you can sort of wrap your mind around how one writes something like that. Whereas something like this, the shifts are so, I mean, there's almost not even necessarily like a chapter change to bring someone else on stage. And is that just, you know, kind of an organic approach, like as you're writing, this person enters onto your page, or is it more deliberate than that?
Well, there's one long section of the book, 90 or 100 pages, that where I was conscious when I began writing it that I wanted to do the whole thing without any space breaks, and that's that. Then the transitions that you're talking about, you know, they become a little bit more conspicuous, because if you want to write 100 or so pages of continuous action with constant perspective changes, but without hitting the return key twice, you got to get pretty inventive about how to get the reader out of one head and into the other. So I tried everything that I knew there to make that technique work. I didn't ever really consider doing the whole book that way, because I think it's kind of exhausting both for me and for the reader. But the thing I liked about it in the moment was that there's a kind of claustrophobia to it. There's a kind of, you know, that small town sense that everybody else is kind of up in your business, whether you like it or not. You know, whether your family knows more about you than you wish they did. Your neighbors know more about you maybe than you realized. And that sense of being close in both good ways and bad. So So in that particular section, I was very conscious of all the transitions and the point of view moves that you're talking about. Elsewhere in the book, I think I allowed it to be a little bit more organic, and I changed it a lot too. I mean, you know, the order in which people appear, that there was a whole lot of revision of that from chapter to chapter.
Can you talk a little bit about your revision process?
Sure. It's not always the same with every book, but in the case of this book, I think, you know, it's six long chapters. The first and the last are shorter than the others, but they're still pretty substantial. And I wrote and rewrote and rewrote each one before moving on to the next one. And the main challenge, I think, with having so many characters and so many perspectives in play was to keep checking in with and doing justice to all the characters, but still making the story itself feel like it was moving conspicuously forward. I mean, if you want to get really technical about it, I have a really inefficient method of revision, which is I still handwrite.
Wow.
The first draft of everything, I handwrite and then type that in to the computer and then print it out and revise on the hard copy and then type that in too. So, you know, if I were more technologically adept, I might put books out faster. But there's something I really like and can't give up about that initial composition, doing it with you know, a pen and a legal pad, you know, in conditions of silence and in a situation where if you write a sentence and you're not crazy about it, there's not really that same temptation to go back and revise it. You just have to kind of keep going, keep thinking, you know, kind of keep yourself in that creative trance.
Yeah, well, that's so interesting. And it's interesting, too, that you say that you revise each chapter before you move on to the next, because I kind of feel like sometimes you don't know what revision needs to be done until you know where you're headed. But do you not feel that?
Well, no, that's true, too. That's true, too. I mean, when I got to the end of the final chapter, certain things that had come before appeared in a different light or appeared less important overall than they did at the time that I first set them down. So, yeah, there's still plenty of revising to do at that point when you've got a draft of the whole. You're right. There's plenty of things that a lot of novel writing is about proportion, and you can't really gauge those things until you at least can see the end.
And how much do you have a sense of where it's heading from the start?
Again, it varies from book to book. In this case, there was a lot about what happened within the book that I was up in the air about, but I always knew that that would be my last chapter, the short final one. That's just from the perspective of Haley, Mark's daughter.
Mm-hmm. And do you have certain, you know, milestones that you know you're aiming towards? Like, did you know from the start that Philip Hoddy was going to become mayor of the town?
Yes, that I think so. You know, now that you ask me, it's hard to go back and forget.
Reconstruct.
Reconstruct what your original thinking was. But I think I know I had that idea pretty early on. Yeah.
That's speaking about Philip Hoddy. He is the New York hedge fund manager who is a summer person who ends up moving to Howland after 9/11, taking up full time residence there, and becoming, as we said, mayor of the town. You know, in a book where, as you said, we get to see the perspectives of a large cast of characters, he is the one character, I think, who really remains a cipher to the reader. And I wonder if you can talk about that choice, too.
Sure. I think that so much of the suspense of the book is dependent on the townspeople not knowing if Hattie is telling, you know, not to make it, whether it, can we believe what he says? Is he telling us the truth? Does, you know, is he sincere? Does he mean what he said? Or is there some kind of secret plan that he's executing? And he's so exotic to them that they are able to project all kinds of fantasies, both light and dark, onto him. And the problem with narrating even a small section from his perspective is that then you kind of give away the answer, and that's a problem not only in terms of drama, but in terms of the reader's subsequent relationship to all the other characters, because then some of them are right and some of them are wrong. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, you know, just from a storyteller's point of view, it's always productive to put the reader in the head of the character who doesn't know what you don't want them to know. So there's plenty of views of Hattie in the book. You have plenty of perspectives, wildly divergent ones, but you never get the corrective of hearing, of being inside his head. You just get to hear what he says, and you try to evaluate it the same as everybody else does.
So in this large range of characters, there is no one here that I can think of who is actually happy. And you know, I think it was Tolstoy who had that famous line about how happy families are all alike and unhappy families are each unhappy in their own way. So I wondered if that choice on your part is reflective of a kind of Tolstoyan philosophy you hold as a writer, or perhaps more reflective of your worldview?
That's a good question. I mean, I it's not my worldview, because I think, like, even in the Privileges, I mean, that was a pretty troubling family in some ways, but they were happy. They loved each other. And so it's not that I consider that off limits or dramatically impossible. But I think, you know, the Locals itself is just a book about a kind of decay, you know, a political, spiritual, moral, familial decay. And so I guess I have to admit that you know, naturally takes the characters in the direction of unhappiness. I mean, I feel kind of guilty about that when you put it that way, but it's true.
Is it hard to write that? I mean, is it hard to, like, kind of live in that space for as long as you're writing that novel?
No, not really. I mean, there are some characters in the book that are more remote from not my experience necessarily, but more remote from my own perspective than others. But I find it kind of energizing to write those characters. I mean, I found it really kind of energizing to write Jerry Firth, for instance, even though Jerry is a guy who in real life I would really have a very hard time spending even an hour with. Mm-hmm. But making the effort, the creative or the imaginative effort to see the world as your characters see them, not to really judge them, but to put yourself, to inhabit them. You know, that's always difficult and engaging in a good way, even if the characters themselves are not really journeying toward happy ends.
This feels like a very political book to me, even while it is also a book that, in, you know, is very personal and very much about the people of the town, and it's not a political diatribe in any way. But I wonder whether, first of all, you think there is such a thing as a political novelist or a political novel, and whether you consider yourself to be one if you do.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, rather than political, I might say social novel. And I've been, you know, I'm thinking a lot about that lately, and about, you know, on the one hand, the state of the world is such that it feels like the social novel might be poised for a sort of comeback. But on the other hand, you know, you can't really write The Grapes of Wrath anymore. You can't really write The Jungle or Maggie or anything like that the way that you used to. The relationship between writers and readers has changed, for one thing. So all my books, you know, the subjects I'm drawn to always tend to be, you know, contemporary and cultural, you know, rather than political in nature. But I feel like, you know, the novel gives you a very particular way of thinking about the world. And I know that some novelists are drawn to writing about worlds that existed hundreds of years ago, or worlds that, you know, may never exist, speculative worlds. But for me, I'm always trying to figure out a way to think imaginatively about what's going on, whether or not you call that. I think this is a novel that looks a lot more political than it would have if it had come out 2 years ago. Let's say that.
Well, that I think is certainly true. But say a little bit more about why you feel like you can't write a novel like The Grapes of Wrath anymore today. I'm curious on your perspective on that.
The history of the novel, I think this is sort of paradoxically, the rise of the novel coincides with kind of overall loss of faith in the magical abilities of the novelist, him or herself. And I think that, you know, a lot of social novels are predicated on the idea, for instance, that you didn't have to be of a certain class or race or gender or economic background or nationality or religion or whatever in order to write about it. That, you know, that Tolstoy could write about the Cossacks without being a Cossack, etc. I think there, you know, the specter of appropriation is
ever present,
you know, and present for writers too, you know, honestly, as it should be. But I think the idea of dramatizing a social conflict or a social problem by representing experiences on either side of that problem, I think it's a lot trickier to do now. And I think that has to do with the audience's loss of faith in the somewhat magical abilities of writers themselves. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think appropriation does come up a lot. But I think that a lot of novelists that I've spoken to kind of take some issue with that because they say that the role of the novelist is to imagine themselves into the lives of others. And mm-hmm. And if you say you can't imagine yourselves into the lives of someone different from you, what is left for the role of the novelist?
Well, plenty. In any novel, unless it's a simple monologue, it's going to involve imagining hypothetical selves, experimental selves. I mean, fiction is all about the experimental self, both for the writer and the reader, and that will never go away. But where each particular writer draws the line for him or herself, that's a personal choice. I mean, you know, when John Updike's response to 9/11 was to write a novel from the point of view of, you know, a Muslim terrorist, and that didn't work so good. You know, I mean, however good the intent was, I think there the sense that there's no line you can't cross because writers, like I say, possess some sort of supernatural empathetic ability. That idea, some of the shine has come off of that.
And I think this is related, you know, right after the election, I had a really hard time reading fiction, and I never have a hard time reading fiction. It was a little terrifying for me, and almost more than anything else, but not anything else. And I wonder, you know, what you, and I guess I was asking myself a lot, you know, like why, like what is the importance of fiction in a world like the one we are living in today? And I wonder if you have an answer for that.
Well, I felt the same way, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the election. And I don't know if it was so much of a loss of faith in fiction or it's just my inability to get off the internet, you know, but, you know, I just saw something online today that pointed out that today was day 193 of the Trump administration, something like that. And it just reminded me of how much our perspective, our sense of time has been foreshortened, in particular since the election. And so I don't think there's anything better really than to be reminded that there's really nothing new under the sun, and that, you know, people suffered in similar ways 100 or 200 years ago. And that's, you know, fiction. I think it was Raymond Carver maybe who said that, you know, good fiction is always a bringing of the news, and just to bring the news to yourself again, that the world is wide and that history is long and that you can get out of the awful bubble that we're in, at least temporarily, and gain some perspective on it by reanimating, you know, other times, other cultures through art, through the novel in particular.
Well, Jonathan, I loved your novel, and I'm really grateful for you for talking to me today.
Thank you, Sid. It was a pleasure.
I'm Sid Oppenheimer, and this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. I want to take a moment to introduce my guests, Mark Oppenheimer and Sam Purdy. Sam Purdy is a longtime educator who is about to start a new job at an education nonprofit, and he last appeared on Book Talk discussing Julie Bunton's novel, Marlena. Mark Oppenheimer teaches at Yale University, writes for the New York Times, the LA Times, and many other esteemed publications, hosts the podcast Unorthodox, and is the father of my four daughters. He also happens to be 43 today. Mark, happy birthday, and thanks for joining me.
By the time people hear this, I'll be 43 in a couple days, but thank you.
Sam, great to hear you. Great to have you here as well.
Wonderful to be back and playing third wheel today with the two of you.
So I wanted to start where I started in the interview with Jonathan, which is at the beginning of this book. I'm curious to know what you two made of this nameless narrator and how you think it sets us up to read or to understand the rest of the book.
Please.
Just because
boy.
My birthday,
yes,
I get to go first,
yes.
Right? Well, yeah, I thought it was really interesting the way that we meet the main character through someone basically taking him for a chump. It was also interesting that scene was in New York City, and the book becomes in many ways about what happens when New York City as an idea, as a metaphor, arrives in the hills of Western Massachusetts. And that's the first place we see it, is in this scene where this Massachusetts yokel basically comes down to New York to try. He has a class action lawsuit that he might get some money out of at some point, and he has to talk to the lawyer who's running it. And he ends up bumping into someone else who's going to be part of the lawsuit. But that guy is this hard-bitten kind of ex-con, many times bankrupt, possibly recovering addict, New Yorker. Like, so one guy has no street smarts and the other guy has a lot of street smarts. And you don't understand at that moment that that's going to play out throughout the entire book. But I think that that sort of reverse angle, as they would call it in filmmaking, where the camera does a 180 and looks at the person who's actually going to be doing the looking for the rest of the book, is really, really interesting. And what's also interesting, of course, is that you don't see it coming. I mean, I really did forget about that intro for most of the book. And then it pops back and you say, oh, right. We learned early on that he had this kind of gullible side to him.
I think something else that really struck me about the placement in New York is it's New York in the day of and the days immediately after September 11th, which Jonathan also talked about. But it's New York, not sort of as New York. And that's what the narrator sort of focuses on. This is not the place that I'm used to. He is especially...
As someone who grew up there yourself.
No, excuse me. I can't say that. I'm wearing a Yankees hat today, but I'm from New Jersey.
Well, you're from nearby, right?
Got to be careful. But I think,
am from New York.
That's right.
No, but the that first narrator, the character who through whom we meet Mark, is unsettled by how much New York does not feel like the way it's supposed to feel after 9/11.
Right.
Especially, he says that there's this neighborly feel, which I think is driven home on his first visit to the post office, where everyone seems all okay with the slow service, and then actually. You know, and this introduces a theme I think we'll talk about, authenticity of a place. He's relieved at the very end of that prologue when finally he goes to the post office a second time, a couple of weeks after 9/11, he says, and after being so unsettled for so long, he's so relieved and just at ease that someone basically goes postal in line, right? We're like, can I get some service? The experience we've all had at a post office. And that in New York City, as he envisions it, of its hard edges, and it's sort of impersonal. I don't quite care about my neighbor and the person next to me, what they might think of what I'm about to do. You know, this guy just blows up.
Right. The rudeness is back. And it's like now he feels all at home again.
This is my place.
This is
the place that I, you know, think this is how I think of this home as being.
Right.
And of course, we launch into meeting Howland and the community that, you know, we are going to see change quite a bit.
Right. And do you think Howland is then set up as a contrast to that? I mean, the idealist image we have of like small town New England is this ideal of neighborliness, you know, in contrast to New York. But I'm not sure that that's the Howland we end up seeing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it certainly is the vision of the small Berkshire's town is a little bit more hard bitten than it's more the reality of the Norman Rockwell pictures, as we now realize, than it is the kind of like insufficient gloss on them where people thought they were all about neighborliness, but they actually always had a kind of dark lining to them. And I think that's true that for the locals there, the Massachusetts, the small town Massachusetts we see is actually one of a lot of people living on the edge. A lot of people actually have a lot in common with the narrator of the first chapter, who's sort of living on the edge, battling addictions, battling demons. And yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think maybe that underneath it all, I mean, underneath it all, it's pretty bleak. Underneath it all, there's a lot of people with a lot of demons and in many cases, a lot of bad motives. The New Englanders we meet are not all sort of virtue and thriftiness. And it looks pretty bleak. I would also add that, you know, Jonathan Dee talked in the interview about how he worried about kind of appropriating cultures that weren't his own. And I don't know about his background, but he's really writing about working class and sort of borderline poor. He's writing about economically precarious New Englanders. And that is a culture that's different from the one that certainly he inhabits now. I mean, it's true that these people are white and by and large Protestant, as he, I presume, is. But they are economically precarious. And one of the things that I think the book seems to be saying is that economically precarious people everywhere have a lot of challenges and can't always afford to be sort of the models of virtue that we like to think of as our thrifty New Englanders are. One thing you have to keep in mind is that these towns, and Dee is writing about this, it's been a long time since they've been just New England towns. They've also become become satellites of New York for summer people and vacationers. So I don't know. I thought a lot of, you know, that the politics of that is always there. And like, what would these towns be like if they didn't have the New York money flowing in, you know?
Right. What Hadi loves about the place and what, you know, others who resettle there for longer periods of time or spend more vacation time there appreciate is, you know, what he said early on in the book in his first encounter with Mark, actually, it stays what it is, which is exactly how I like it, which is such a perfect line. Then, of course, later on, there's that new restaurant, which when it arrives, that to me feels like the real beginning of the explosive change, and it comes at the beginning of, I believe, the second or third chapter. And that restaurateur says, you wanted to give them what was local. He sees Hadi. He says, you know, we're kindred spirits who had seen the promise in this unspoiled little place.
Right.
And here he is creating a restaurant that is sort of this essentially hyper-local, but totally inauthentic place. So when we think about whether, you know, what Howland is, it's at the time we encounter it, I think I agree with you, Mark, it's too late to determine what's essentially Howland and what is Howland acting out its sort of projection.
Right, right.
And Sam, you mentioned that word authenticity. And Mark, you had raised this in some pre-conversation we had prior to taping. And I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about how you see authenticity as playing out in this novel.
Well, I think that, yeah, there definitely is this expectation that everyone is playing these certain roles, right? So that the New Yorkers come to the small New England town expecting them to perform New England, which means you want a contractor who's, you know, salt of the earth and is a straight shooter and who gets his egg sandwich at, what's the place he gets his egg sandwich?
Daisy's.
Does he go to Daisy's? And then there's also the Undermountain, right? There's like competing
right.
local greasy spoons, and each one is supposed to be authentic in its own way. And so the New Englanders are kind of performing, they're expected to perform in, you know, New Englander drag, basically, which is to be super duper authentic. And then, of course, the New York billionaire, Hadi, who moves in, he kind of starts dressing that way, but then he can't fully do it because he always has on his crisp white Oxford shirt underneath his Patagonia or his North Face or his Canada Goose or whatever. So then, but then someone points out, one of the characters thinks in his head, but of course, maybe that is authentic him in that he has a closet full of those shirts. So everyone is kind of, it's so hard for people to be themselves, which I think is one of the things that makes it a really fine novel, is it is so psychologically acute, which is everyone is figuring out how to perform what they want to be. Hadi's wife, when she goes to the yoga place, to Asana, you know, she's going up there to perform some vision of serenity. And it's really only the younger generation. It's Haley,
right? Haley,
for example, who is trying to figure, who's basically calling people on their nonsense and saying, like, I'm surrounded by all these people pretending to be this, pretending, you know, couples pretending to be in love who aren't, New Yorkers pretending to be New Englanders who aren't, New Englanders pretending to be one kind of New Englander. And the fact, just to finish this thought, that even the central family, the Firths, who are supposed to be like, you know, like blood and soil Howlanders, are actually from a town, right? Aren't they from a couple towns over?
Right.
They're not real Howlanders either. But they talk about it as if, well, we've been here for centuries, but they've actually been from a different town for centuries. So there's always that question of like, who's inside, who's outside.
I think that before we kind of go, because I think we'll want to talk about Haley more, I think before going there, I just wanted to raise another aspect of the authenticity theme for me, which was masculinity and who's sort of who's a real man.
Mm.
You know, that comes up again and again, especially in the framing of the Firths. Mark, you know, when he first gets back, refers to Jerry as a hyper-masculine image of their father. Jerry is the youngest of the four kids. And Candace, in one of her moments, she's the sister who's local, is remarking that these towns were full of men like her landlord, not just cheap and simple, but proud of it, superior about it. And Mark, actually, when it comes to the idea of authenticity and performance, Mark really couches his relationship with Hadi, especially in the early going, and his desire to really soak up Hadi-ness and sort of become it as something manly. You know, he says that he's the brand of man Mark longed to be, which is funny in some sense because Hadi has to perform some of that New Englander-ness you described is sort of a masculinity. But he's actually, you know, that's not necessarily Hadi's essence.
Because there are different rubrics of manliness, right? And before I say something about that, had you thought about the fact that Hadi sounds like haughty?
No, H-A-U-G-H-T-Y? I had thought that it sounded like Turkish or which
no,
I googled.
No, I thought that too. I did
and
too.
It is. I wondered why it was never a thing. It's a Turkish.
Is it a Turkish name?
It is.
It sounds like haughty, like, hey, he's a haughty. It also sounds like haughty, like he's being haughty. And I think, and both of those are correspond in a sense to the New Yorker role he's portraying. But that's right. So Mark Firth, the contractor who meets him, thinks that Hottie has a certain kind of manly charisma, which comes from sort of not giving a damn what anyone else thinks.
Taking what's
and just
yours.
Taking what's yours and having money and just walking into a place and saying, I'm going to make this mine, including, as we learn, he kind of makes the whole town his, you know, his
fiefdom.
His fiefdom.
Something.
And so, but that's one kind of manliness. Another kind is being able to build stuff, which is what Mark Firth can do. Another kind is being able to like throw a punch, which is what his subcontractor, right. Barrett, the carpenter, does. Another kind is like being able to get the ladies, which is what his brother Jerry does. And there's all, each of them has kind of like their one little, you know, particular vein of manliness, and then has a lot of antipathy and a lot of animosity towards the ones who have the ones that they don't have. But yeah, so there's a lot of that kind of insecurity about, I agree, about what it is to be masculine.
I think there is a lot of that insecurity, except when it comes to Hottie. We don't see that, at least again, because we don't get inside his head. We don't see him having any jealousy or insecurity when it comes to that. I mean, his only moment of insecurity is when Mark tells him, when they have the first meeting, and Mark mentions to him, oh, yes, I know where you live because we're neighbors, actually, and I can see your house from mine. And he shows this sort of slight sign of irritation because he doesn't like being in a position where someone knows something that he doesn't. And in my mind, that kind of speaks to his notion of maybe not masculinity, but his sense of self is that he's always the person who knows more.
I would add maybe two possible places where he's insecure as well. One is that he is trying to figure out how to change his appearance. He is trying, even though he doesn't go all the way, there it is observed by others that he's trying to look more and more like the guy who fits in. He's trying to figure out where the locals shop and what they do, where they eat. He wants to be authentic. You know, he takes on the local, becoming a regular at one of the local places to the point where they name a sandwich after him, right?
And does not go, by the way, to that fancy new place.
And does not go to the fancy new place, right? So he is clearly trying to play act a little bit, which I think suggests some insecurity. And then, of course, the other thing is that, you know, after having become first selectman, the first time that anyone raises any objection to him as first selectman, he kind of, you know, folds his cards. It really it's unclear if he's humiliated by it or just doesn't want to stick around for a possible humiliation. But he actually doesn't seem to have much fight in him when it comes down to it. So that was really interesting to me as well. And I did resent a little bit in a playful way. I resented that Jonathan Dee didn't give us more insight into that. We didn't have the chapter told from his point of view.
Yeah, I want to talk about Hottie's choice to resign as selectman and just pull up his roots and go back to New York. And Sam, what did you make of that? I mean, I think the ultimate question is, you know, again, Hottie is this cipher. How do you read him?
I think that, you know, Howland essentially becomes a something of a toy for him. And when you are, you know, playing with your own toy or building your own house or, you know, building an addition or something inside, you're not really affecting anyone else. It's kind of your thing to do. And he, you know, he's a man who trades stocks. He invests. He plays with money. He's not a people person. And so it doesn't quite strike him that he's what he's doing that feels kind of mostly self-serving, though, sure, there are other people involved. It doesn't really hurt anyone or affect anyone. In fact, he feels like he's making things better. So I actually don't think that there's more morality is completely absent here in terms of the question. Sort of, I think we all think, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? It's irrelevant. You know, he actually just realizes in himself, oh, I guess at this point, it's now important for me that the people around me feel a certain kind of way because now I'm invested in this place. And so I'm going to pay Daisy's, you know, mortgage on her place. You know, I'm going to do these things that support this place I've become invested in. But it's neither a great act of service or, I think, some, you know, obscene colonialism on his part. It's just sort of, this is the place that I'm now going to make as most pleasurable to me as I can.
Yeah, it was this sense of, like, it's exactly what you said, sense seeming as a toy, like he's building his own little Lego village. And he does what he needs to do to make sure the village looks as beautiful as he wants it to. And then, but you know, then there is that moment when there are intimations of rebellion and he decides, okay, well, you know, I'll
take my ball and go home.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, right? Like, that's exactly right.
I found that to be, whether intentionally or not, I assume that most of the book was written before the election of last November, but I found it to be very, very political in the sense that it's talking about somebody who thinks, you know, that the executive office can, that the executive can just bend everything else to the will, you know, to its own will. And so the legislature, which in this town is a three-person board of selectmen, of which the executive, the first selectman, is one of the three, And then there are a couple employees, and there's no judiciary to speak of. So basically, it's just a strong executive coming in and saying, we're going to win a lot and we're going to do it. And if need, and it's a billionaire. It's a strong billionaire New York executive saying, let me show you how things are done. And I think that it also gets to the question of how much do we respect democracy? Because he moves to this town in part because it's the kind of place that would have government by town hall meeting. And then he essentially decides, but in order to keep it this way, we need a little bit less democracy. He even says at one point, well, we've tried democracy. That hasn't worked well for things like this. So I'll just put up.
We end up with compromise and half measures.
Right. And I'll just put up surveillance cameras on my own and we just won't worry about that. So it really, you know, I think the book stares at the reader and asks the question, you know, how much democracy do people want?
You could also think in terms of the political moment of Jerry, you know, as sort of this.
The brother.
Yeah.
Former real estate agent. Yeah.
Right. Who.
Blogger.
And who, you know, really, I think, is the one who has the most sort of fierce feelings of masculinity threatened and lost, as representing the sort of archetypal Trump voter in, you know, in 2015 and 16, you know, who feels like they want something better. And he even on page in our version, 257, is having this barstool conversation saying, nothing I do means anything, he said suddenly. I just want to mean something, to stand for something. But it isn't just me either. I feel like it's all been, what's that word, like with gas? Someone says pumped, siphoned away from us. But by what or who or whom, I guess. I want to lead a life that's more, it's back there somewhere. Yeah, in the past. It's not here now, but I know it existed because otherwise, how would I miss it? I mean, isn't he saying, let's make America great again?
He is totally saying that. I thought that if there was one thing I wanted, two things I wanted more of. One was I would have loved to see inside Hottie's head. But I understand. I understand why Jonathan Dee made the choice, because as he said in the interview, if I had done that, then it would have rendered half the characters wrong in their perceptions of him, and others would have been the ones to get him right. And I absolutely buy that. Like, it actually might have made it a weaker novel. The other thing, though, was I left the novel intensely curious about how these four siblings were reared, because they were reared by people who seemed to have, you know, the dad, I guess, was a contractor himself and seemed to have a strong marriage and strong roots in the community, strong sense of place. And yet his four kids all end up really, really weak in certain.
Oh, but I don't think they have a strong marriage at all. I mean, there's moments where Candace talks about how she doesn't want to be married and how, and the reason is because of having witnessed her parents' marriage and how basically she feels like they always hated each other.
Well, I just meant that it lasted.
That doesn't mean it was strong,
right. Well,
though.
You're right. Okay, fair. That's a good point. But you get the sense there was a kind of stolidity, like that his dad wasn't sitting around having existential crises, that his dad, like, went to work, built the houses, and maybe not. Maybe
I just think we just don't know, because that actually is so much at odds with, I don't, you know, I want you to finish your point, but I do think that it's fundamentally wrong. No, I
I'm not sure you do want me to finish my point, actually.
We don't see that at all, and there isn't so much retrospection.
It's just, you know, maybe as one of four children myself, who are all, I think, relatively functional, I was curious, you know, I wanted some sort of seminal rupture in their childhood. I wanted something alluded to that basically sent them all spinning off in such mutually hostile directions. But I actually thought that was fairly brave on Dee's part. There aren't too many books about a bunch of siblings, all of whom are in their way kind of screwed up and don't like, who are in relation to each other, who aren't estranged, but who don't like each other. And I thought that was kind of cool, actually.
And the thing is, you know, they're not completely dysfunctional, right? They all have jobs. You know, Candace is an elementary school assistant principal, and Jerry for part of the novel until he gets fired as a real estate agent. Mark is a contractor.
Two of them don't have jobs. One married well and moved to Colorado.
Well, we actually don't even know if she has a job or not. But she's married and seems to have a functional family life
with her crazy politics and blog
with her
reading.
Crazy politics. Yeah. But I'm just saying that, look, everyone is a little dysfunctional in their own way. On the surface, they are more or less functional than the average Joe in the town. I mean, Jerry does lose his job, but for much of the novel, and you know, Candace loses her job too, or she quits, but for much of the novel, they are functioning adults. And I think that's almost the point, is like, it's what's underneath. Again, this question of authenticity is like, on the surface, they seem pretty functioning, but underneath, which is where we get to see, which is peeled back, we see the layers of dysfunctionality. And what is striking to me about that is the way that it kind of mirrors the town. That, like, on the surface, the town seems to be functioning okay, but there's actually this decay going on. And I think what happened in the Firth family is that, you know, it was never acknowledged and never dealt with. And in fact, you see that in the relationship between the parents and what's happening with the mom as she's suffering dementia, and no one is willing to say it out loud. And at one point, you know, Candace even says, nobody wanted to admit what was wrong with mom, not because they were emotional or scared or in denial, but simply because admitting it would oblige them to do something about it.
Right. And as men, they don't want to, they figure she'll just pick up the slack.
I think partly they figure she'll pick up the slack, but partly, again, it speaks to, you know, what's happening in the town is no one wants to have to do something about it. And that's the appeal of someone like Hottie, who's going to come in and they don't have to do anything about it. There doesn't have to be an increase in taxes. They don't have to actually do anything. Let someone else take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Can I just add, though, that Mark, for instance, actually really does think that he's doing something about his family. And so I think both he and Candace have these different views. Candace is the one who's there. She's present. She's the one who, you know, seems to be the first to get a phone call when something happens. But Mark's real gripe is, hey, wait a second. I give you all money. I've loaned you money. I paid for mom and dad's thing. Jerry, I brought him in on the business. I don't necessarily know who's right or wrong. Mark certainly doesn't seem to be really right. Let's put it that way. But, you know, there isn't actually this whole admitted thing of, oh, Candace is the one who deals with mom and dad, or Candace is the one holding the family together. I think, you know, Mark definitely feels like he plays that role. He hosts Thanksgiving when it comes down to it. So I don't know. That seems a little bit up for grabs. But I agree with you that there is something unstated, and that Candace is the one who is most willing to just call it for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess I would just return to the fact that part of what's unstated is that they are, at least career-wise, very dysfunctional. I mean, it's true that Mark is able to lend everyone money, but then he goes into bankruptcy. And it turns out that he's both very capable, but also very incapable. And, you know, Candace, obviously, you know, really
but none I would of caution that, because I think that there is an open question in the book as to how at fault Mark is for this and how much he is subject to kind of the social and economic forces around him. Like, he ultimately ends up being a victim of the Great Recession. And is it because of, you know, bad choices he's made? Well, there are a lot of people who made those choices because in the context of the time, they seem to make sense. And then the kind of, you know, what was happening with banks and their willingness to lend and things that were kind of beyond his control closed in on him. And he is the victim. And, you know, so I'm not sure that speaks to his own dysfunction.
It's both, because he decided to become he was someone with a reasonably good career as a contractor, who then decided to become a house flipper.
Because he was ambitious, right?
Right.
Like, he wanted to succeed. He wanted to have kind of this haughty vision of success where he has money.
But that's a character flaw, right? Is
ambition a character flaw?
No, but inability to face reality, right? Which he didn't have those skills. I mean, he was bad at flipping. And
this is after where we first learn about him is that he actually got taken in by his swindler.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear. Certainly his wife views him as someone who is a kind of foolish dreamer, who actually thinks of himself as a great entrepreneur, someone who should be wealthy, but doesn't want to just do the work for it or do the thing that he's good at for it, that there's a kind of naivete there. But look, that is absolutely what the financial crisis preyed on, right? Is people with a sort of what should be a kind of forgivable amount of naivete who just want a little something more, and now saying, here's easy money, here are easy mortgages, here. He just happens to be one of the people who fell for it.
Well, we have a couple more minutes, and I wanted to finish by talking about the end of the book and finally returning to Haley, as you had requested earlier, Sam. Haley makes this stance towards the end. Her mom works at Caldwell House, which is this estate that is on the outskirts of Howland that belonged to this very wealthy New Yorker family a century ago and was left to be pristine and untouched. And she is helping her mom, hanging out there during her high school summer, and decides that she is going to take up residency there as a kind of statement of protest that this house should be allowed to stand there as kind of a monument to these wealthy New Yorkers who actually never did anything for the town. So again, I wonder what you make of that as a statement. I wonder what you make of it as an ending to the novel and what it kind of left you with.
Well, I think it's fitting in several senses. Mark, you referenced that, you know, Haley sort of represents this next generation. And I think that there's something poignant just in the simple fact of ending there. But for me, it came back to how we always saw Haley throughout the book. And it was on page 165 that she was introduced as someone who suffered when others suffered, less from empathy than a sense of justice. That was when she was in elementary school or middle school and some kid would get picked on. And this was, you know, a more mature sense of outrage at, you know, why is this house standing by itself and, you know, the nicest house in town, not just, you know, having the whole of the economic effects that we've seen that it had with its tax-free status midway through the book, but also actually a symbol that people aren't even willing to call out as a false symbol, where actually she, for a research project, though easily accessible, this information is on Wikipedia, you know, sort of uncovers that, you know, the story that everyone buys is totally bogus. It's a sense of justice and, you know, sort of late teens calling it as it is, that all the adults don't quite see, that feels perfectly appropriate and a good place to end. Not that we really can see in any way what's headed for Howland, what's going for Haley or for the, you know, now separated, you know, Firth parents. But I think that it's sort of the most extreme, I'm not quite sure what's going on here,
right,
ending of a character committed to this vague idea of justice.
Well, I think she's the only one in the book who has a pretty pure sense of morality, who has a kind of clarity. I mean, she's stubborn. She's not a particularly likable character, but she's doing something because she thinks it's the right thing to do, not because she's trying to heal some sort of ego wound in herself. I mean, yes, you could say that she enjoys the fact that it upsets her mother, for sure, but she basically says beds are to be slept in. The idea that we have this house that goes unlived in for many months of the year because a rich person set it aside to be unlived in is morally obtuse and it's absurd. And so I'm going to do some living in it. And it's just a kind of, it's like this plumb line that you can sort of gauge by looking at it. You can see how off kilter everyone else is, where they want to build stuff for the money, or they want to move to a town and remake it for their own, you know, ego gratification, or because of their own fears of terrorism, or because of how their own marriage is, you know, off kilter in New York. She has nothing to gain from this. She's just saying it's wrong. And so there is something that kind of that looks back at the rest of the novel and sets everything off in an interesting light that way.
Well, Mark and Sam, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to have been here.
Does this mean I get to have dinner tonight?
This is your birthday present. I'm Sid Oppenheimer, awesome. And this is Book Talk on WNHH 103.5 FM. Next up, New Haven librarian Margaret Gerges recommends Untwined by Edwidge Danticat.
I'm Margaret Gerges, teen librarian at the New Haven Free Public Library. I'm here to recommend and review the Young Adult Book of the Week, Untwined, by author Edwidge Danticat. The dictionary defines untwine as to unwind the twisted or tangled parts of, disentangle, to remove by unwinding. Imagine being born with a duplicate, a mirror image, a copy, if you will. Twins are mysterious to us. Many have their own language, and even studies have shown that twins separated at birth, who do not even know of each other, have remarkable similarities. Not only do they share traditional scientific traits such as genetics and health issues, but they may take on similar jobs, marry similar spouses, and have children with the same names. Not all twins are identical, of course, but the bonds between twins are stronger than even science understands. Some people even believe that twins share a single soul. So what happens when that soul, that duplicate, that other half of your heart, is ripped away from you? How does a twin survive the agony of death? When Giselle wakes up in the hospital, she recalls the carriage that death visited in, a red minivan out of control, determined to steal her sister's life, crashing over and over into them. Those moments in the hospital when the pain was suddenly so great that she nearly passed out, is that when Isabel left her? Those moments later when Isabel came to her alone and told her to go on. But can she? Can she move on when every moment of every single day is another moment when Isabel won't exist? And who is she without Isabel? What does a twin without their double become? A book about loss, a book about grief, a book about pain, but most of all, a book about love. Untwined is the story of a girl discovering herself when her heart is ripped out from her. For more teen books and programs, come visit the library's newly opened Teen Center at the Ives Main Library at 133 Elm Street. You can find more information on our website at www.nhfpl.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. As a reminder, all books discussed on Book Talk can always be found at the New Haven Free Public Library.
Thanks, Margaret. On our next show, airing August 23rd, we'll be discussing the novel The Chalk Artist, first with the author, Allegra Goodman, and then with my guests, Alice Baumgartner and Brad Ridke. Make sure to tune in. You can see what else is coming up and listen to old episodes on our website, booktalkradio.net. And, as ever, you can share your thoughts about this episode of Book Talk or any other on Facebook or Twitter, or by emailing me directly at booktalkwnhh@gmail.com. Until next time, happy reading.